Hello, everyone. You are listening to Peace Radio. Joel Maxwell here with Sally Prine and Joel Wagner.
Hello.
And, what are we talking about today?
Oh, just stuff. Per usual. We are going to continue with a little more information about this League of Women Voters poverty poverty study. There are also a couple of anniversaries we want to touch on, the 1,000 days that Bradley Manning has been in prison without trial, and the 10-year anniversary of the run-up to the Iraq War, which is right now, 10 years ago.
Yeah, it seems like it's just flown by.
Not so much.
Right. Oops.
So, and I have a few things on the Cobell settlement from the BIA and some interesting news from Indian country and green industry.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Some headlines. To begin with, hundreds of thousands of Spaniards marched across Spain yesterday in a massive citizens' tide of protests against austerity. Protest groups joined forces under the slogans Citizens' Tide 23F, choosing February 23rd since it marks the anniversary of an attempted coup in 1981 by right-wing officers who tried to crush Spain's young democracy and restore military rule. Today's protest organizers say Spain is facing a new coup, a financial coup, and called on people to march against what they said was government favoritism towards banks and moneyed interests at the expense of the 99%. Spaniards have been enraged by austerity cutbacks and tax hikes imposed by the conservative government of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. Spain is in its second recession in 3 years and has 26% unemployment. The movement unites workers in various sectors such as teachers, nurses, doctors, students, and minors with groups such as environmentalists and small political parties. Quote, "We have come because because of it all. Unemployment, corrupt politicians, the young people who have no future. It's a combination of everything," said Luis Mora, 55, a construction worker. In news closer to home, six aging, single-walled underground storage tanks are leaking radioactive waste, threatening groundwater below the Hanford nuclear site, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee announced Friday afternoon. The seeping waste adds to decades of soil contamination caused by leaking storage tanks at Hanford in the past and threatens to further taint groundwater below the Columbia River, according to officials. The newly disclosed leaking tanks were revealed by Inslee just a week after the U.S. Energy Department disclosed that radioactive waste was found to be escaping from only one tank at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Quote, "This is disturbing news for all Washingtonians," Inslee said in a statement released by his office. "This certainly raises serious questions about the integrity of all 149 single-shell tanks with radioactive liquid and sludge at Hanford. We received very disturbing news today. I think that we are going to have a course of new action, and that will be vigorously pursued in the next several weeks." The Energy Department issued a brief statement acknowledging that six waste tanks were found to be leaking and adding that there was no immediate public health risk. The Energy Department said a week ago that declining liquid levels in just one tank at Hanford showed it was leaking at a rate of 150 to 300 gallons per year. Wow. The U.S. government built Hanford during World War II as part of the Manhattan Project to build the nuclear bomb. The site produced plutonium for the bomb dropped on the Japanese city Nagasaki and continued producing plutonium for the new U.S. nuclear arsenal for years. Yeah, that's
crazy.
Crazy. The U.S. government's censorship of torture testimony by defendants at the Guantanamo Military Commission has been challenged by the ACLU, which called the practice legally untenable and morally abhorrent. On Thursday, the ACLU filed a petition, quote, "to enforce the public's constitutional right of access to the Military Commission prosecution of individuals accused of committing the September 11, 2001 attacks." It added, "There is simply no basis in law for the Orwellian proposition that the government owns or controls and thus can classify and seek to censor defendants' personal experiences and memories of a torture and unlawful detention program whose entire purpose was to forcibly disclose the torture and detention to the defendants. Additionally, the government chose to disclose its secret to defendants who the government concedes were not authorized to receive them. It has no legitimate interest now, let alone a compelling one, in censoring those secrets from the public. The public's interest in the openness and legitimacy of these proceedings, the most important terrorism prosecution of our time, could hardly be greater. The protective order provisions censoring from the public's defendants' testimony about government torture and other abuse could hardly be more extraordinary or draconian. In December, Military Judge Colonel James Poole, who was presiding over the trial, approved the U.S. government's request to keep the details of defendants' torture from the public and allowed for a 40-second delay on the audio feed of the proceedings. Quote, the judge's decision to keep testimony about torture secret did not even mention the American public's First Amendment right of access to the Guantanamo commissions, let alone apply the high standard that must be met before testimony is suppressed, said Hina Shamshi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project. She added in a statement, the government's claim that it can classify and censor from the public a criminal defendant's personal experience is legally untenable. Even if the government somehow had that Orwellian classification authority, copious details about the CIA's torture and black site detention program are already public knowledge, and the government has no legitimate reason to censor the defendant's testimony about their own memories of it. In other news, with little more than a note to Congress, President Obama announced Friday morning that he has ordered the deployment of approximately 100 armed U.S. forces to the West African country of Niger. According to the Associated Press, Obama's letter stated that the mission would be to conduct intelligence sharing with French troops stationed in the neighboring country of Mali, who have joined that country's army in a fight with Tuareg fighters in the north. As AP notes, the U.S. and Niger signed an agreement last month spelling out legal protections and obligations of Americans who might operate from the African nation. But the U.S. officials declined at the time to discuss specific plans for a military presence in the country. The announcement of boots on the ground in Niger comes just weeks after reports surfaced that the U.S. was in negotiations to establish an airbase in the country so that a portion of its drone fleet could operate in the region. Events in Mali that led to the current violence followed on the U.S. NATO intervention in Libya in 2011. The cumulative effect, however, has been a growing chorus of Western officials who say that West Africa is now the new front on the war on terror. And the increased military presence from Libya, then Mali, and now Niger suggests that the buildup in the region is just beginning. In the era of executive authority, almost entirely enabled by the annually renewed authorization for use of military force enacted after the events of 9/11, the question remains, at what point will Congress reassert its right to control declarations of war, and at what point will the U.S. public begin to question a war on terror that can deploy U.S. soldiers in a foreign nation with the quick delivery of a simple presidential note? And in our last headline for this hour, Yale University has come under fire this week for a proposed research center that will train U.S. Special Operations Forces on, quote, interview techniques, unquote, using immigrants from the local community to practice their interrogation skills.
Wow.
I'm full of cheering.
I'm sure that won't go awry.
What could possibly go wrong? Right?
Nothing. It'll be fine.
The center, which has been proposed by psychiatry professor Charles Morgan, would be funded by $1.8 million from the Department of Defense and may be in operation as early as April. The story gained attention after Yale students Nathalie Batreville and Alex Liu published an op-ed in their school newspaper that outlines concerns about the center, including how it will impact New Haven's immigrant community, as well as implications of the university aligning itself with the goals of the U.S. military. Military intelligence does not exist in a vacuum, the students write. It is gathered to support a particularly foreign policy agenda, the morality of which is not beyond question. The techniques soldiers learn at Yale might be used, for example, to identify candidates for President Obama's kill list, which is itself unethical and likely illegal, they continue. By training soldiers to perform these interrogations, Yale would be complicit in achieving these goals. The U.S. military has objectives, and we have to question what those objectives are, Batreville said in an interview with Democracy Now! On Thursday. Under the auspices of medical research, Morgan has previously conducted controversial research on interrogation techniques, according to Democracy Now. The tests monitored the heartbeat of research subjects, all from non-American Arabic-speaking cultures, while they underwent simulated interrogation techniques used by the U.S. military. In contrast, the newly proposed Yale Research Center would study the use of deception to draw information out of subjects. The new facility, USSOCOM, Center of Excellence for Operational Neuroscience, would be part of the Yale School of Medicine. Speaking to Democracy Now!, Michael Siegel, Yale alumnus and professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health, stated, quote, Yale has now crossed a line, using the practice of medicine and medical research to help design advanced interrogation techniques, or even just regular civilian intelligence gathering and interviewing techniques, is not an appropriate use of medicine. The practice of medicine was designed to improve people's health, and the School of Medicine should not be taking part in either training or research that is primarily designed to enhance military objectives.
Right. First, do no harm.
Right, right. Right. Mm-hmm. They seem to have forgotten that.
Yes.
Anyway, now we'll have a song, and this is Ben Harper with Charlie Musselwhite.
I don't believe a word you say. I don't believe. I don't believe a word you say. I don't believe. I don't believe a word you say. I don't believe. I don't believe a word you say. I don't believe. I see your mouth moving, but there's a circus coming out. Always busy proving what the world's all about. Now it's no use.
Was Ben Harper and Charlie Musselwhite. Guess what the name of that song was?
We liked it.
Yes.
Anyway.
We're having some technical difficulties, so I'll just talk while the other two chat.
Anyway, we're going to, or I'm going to finish the thing we started 2 weeks ago. For those of you who remember, mm-hmm. the study of poverty in Latah County put on, 2012. The study mm-hmm. done by the League of Women Voters, wonderful organization. And we ended with healthcare, and so I'm just going to summarize mm-hmm. what they found, healthcare in Latah County, for poor people and mm-hmm. people who, and they, one of the things they did was, you know, went to the various health facilities to say, you know, what do you do with people with who can't pay?
Yeah.
No money, no insurance. And there is a considerable amount of poverty, of course, in this county. For many people in America and here in Latah County, lack of access to appropriate health care contributes to poverty, and in turn, poverty contributes to the lack of appropriate or preventative physical or mental health care. The primary reasons individuals do not have access to necessary health care is the absence of insurance to cover the high costs, or just the absence of money to cover the high costs. Yeah, it's horrible. Even with insurance, many people have difficulties. Mm-hmm. Often urgent and unexpected health care expenses can be financially devastating for individuals and families, resulting in homelessness and a worsening health status. Chronic untreated health problems can decrease an individual's ability to become gainfully employed or to continue to work and may progress to a permanent disability. People with disabilities are more than twice as likely to live in poverty. And in 2010, 2 years ago from when this study was done, 11.4% of Latah County residents had no health insurance.
Wow.
Not surprising, because mm-hmm. I know many of them, and mm-hmm. I know you do as well. Those who do not have health insurance or who have inadequate health insurance habitually do not seek the usual and necessary health care services. Their care, when sought, is most frequently in emergency rooms, the least, of course, cost-effective option.
Yes.
Additionally, Latah County is a designated medically underserved area, as are most Idaho counties, which contributes to the problem of access to health care. There is a shortage of primary care providers in Latah County, especially in the outlying communities. Mm-hmm. The medically disenfranchised come from all economic backgrounds and live anywhere in America, but they all share one common feature. They are without a regular and continuous source of primary care. So ERs pick up the slack. Gritman Medical Center provided $1.2 million in charity care for 2011. Thus, the cost of health care for those without health insurance places a burden on mm-hmm. the system and on the rest. Federally qualified health centers do provide access to primary health, dental, and mental health care on a sliding scale or affordable fee basis. Latah County does not have one of these facilities. The closest ones are Lewiston, 35 miles away, Plummer, 50 mm-hmm. miles away, and Coeur d'Alene, 90 miles away. And then, of course, transportation is a barrier.
Yes.
Which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. People with marginal financial resources can lose what assets they do have to pay for necessary health care and subsequently be pushed below the poverty line. People already living in poverty are frequently unable to pay for housing, food, child care, and education, let alone health care. So it's mm-hmm. just a huge
It problem. Snowballs on
snowballs.
You.
Snowballs, absolutely.
Yep.
Their study included mental health care, and one in four Americans experiences a mental health disorder in a given year, and one in 17 Americans lives with a serious mental illness. So this is another issue that's difficult. Mm. Persons who require mental health service are already vulnerable and underserved. As with medical care, if a person does not have insurance or cannot afford the care, there is limited access. So how is the problem being addressed? So the writers in the studiers of this problem came up with a few places. Community hospitals, of course, there are two in this area, Gritman and Pullman Regional Hospital Services, and St. Joseph Regional Medical Center in Lewiston is the largest full-service medical center between Boise and Spokane.
Mm-hmm.
Public health services, the Idaho Public Health, the Public Health Idaho North Central District helps with community education and preventative medicine. But not necessarily primary care. Nutritional services through WIC, prenatal and health clinics, family planning, AIDS testing, and et cetera. But staff reductions have occurred due to budget cuts from all sources of income budgeted for staffing. Children birth to 18 are fairly well covered for required vaccines through the health department, but adults have less coverage for vaccines and other services and may be referred to other health resources. So two problems for low-income families needing services are the families' lack of information about the services or eligibility requirements, and number two, families' lack of information about transportation options when they are unable to get to the health department. And I think one of the things that they found when they did this study was how difficult it was to, that how hard it was to link all the needs and there are services available, but finding what they are is really difficult. So there are a few places. The indigent care, health care in Lato County. County provides necessary medical services to any legal resident of the county who is in need of such services and does not have income, medical insurance, or other means to pay for these services and is not eligible for Medicaid. Children are covered by the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services program. And just to let you know, this study is available in all seven libraries of the Lato County District. So just ask for at the front desk. It's a really wonderfully complete study that was done.
And not overly long. It's right. Concise.
Right. So they ask, what are the deficiencies? And that's one of the first thing they list is that there's no single point of access to information regarding healthcare services. And Moscow does not yet have a federally qualified health center for low-income people. More options are needed for transportation. For example, there's no bus to the PHINCD in Moscow, or no options exist for health-related transportation between Lewiston and Moscow. There's no bus for that.
There is occasionally a bus to the casino, and then you can take another spur bus back down to Plummer. But you'll need all day.
You'll need all day, and if you're sick. Right.
Well,
that's tough.
Cough into your elbow
on
the bus.
Right.
Yeah, it is tough.
And another deficiency that they noted was that mental illness remains stigmatized and misunderstood and is therefore often inadequately addressed, and funding for and the existence of programs is woefully inadequate. And this last part we see at the library, computer literacy education, access to online resources is a very limiting problem for those with health and mental health care needs. It's really hard to find your way through all this. So good job, women. It's terrific.
Can I add one thing to that from a medical article I read? Because there's more and more pressure on emergency rooms because so many people are using them. And, of course, budgets are cut everywhere. They're finding that people who go in with serious problems to an ER, especially an oversubscribed ER, are coming out with PTSD, post-traumatic stress, in addition to their illness because it's such a traumatizing experience. With the volume, you know, the noise levels, the number of people coming in and out.
Like watching ER on
so you go in with a heart attack and you come out with a bad heart and a mental illness it's been so stressful. And they said people with regular health care and a regular provider aren't getting that because they go to the doctor.
A person that you
contact, or they're known already at the hospital or not considered a frequent flyer, as they say. So it's got collateral damage as well as the obvious, you know, strain on the system. It's creating more strain on the people who use the system that way because they have to.
And then you would.
And then there's no mental health care. So.
Then you would opt not to do that again.
So I know a lot of people who opt not to go, and you have to fight them, and then you end up in the ER with them, and you understand why. You know, 12-hour agonizing day.
Oh dear. Yeah.
Yes. It's so that was a charming study to read.
Well, in case you're wondering why we have these huge problems with poverty, we have here Ed Asner to explain.
Yay. He was a newsman on TV.
He was. And we believe him. Yes. To explain why we have growing in inequality and why we have poverty. So, mm-hmm. Ed, talk to us.
Once upon a time, there was a land that was happy and prosperous. It had a great education system, safe streets, and jobs for everyone. There were a few poor people and a few rich people. Most were in the middle. The people of this land paid for their good life by investing in their future together. They called this paying taxes. Everyone paid what they could afford. The poor people paid a little, the people in the middle paid a middling amount, and the rich people, 1% of everyone, paid more than the others. Just about everyone thought that this was best. But over time, rich people decided they weren't rich enough, so they came up with ways to get richer. The first way was through tax cuts. They didn't mind if this meant fewer services for everyone. They said, why should I care about other non-rich people? I can hire teachers, safety, waste disposal people to work for me for less money than taxes cost. And then I can keep the rest of my taxes for me. The second way rich people got richer was through tax loopholes. These are laws that allow people to avoid paying taxes, with the idea that it's beneficial for other people, too, if this group didn't pay. The third way rich people got richer was to pay no taxes at all. This is called tax evasion. Of course, if all the people did this, everything would fall apart. But rich people and giant companies they owned figured no one would notice. This is illegal, but many did it anyway. And so it went. In 20 years, rich people doubled their share of the land's income. Schools, public safety, the roads, parks, libraries, public transportation, all went into decline. The rich people didn't care. They said everyone gets what they deserve, and they bought their own teachers, police, garbage collectors, and transportation. They also bought something else, elections. They spent so much money on politics, they elected people who liked what they liked. More tax cuts for the rich and big businesses, and fewer schools, road repairs, police, firefighters, and nurses for everyone else. When the 99% became upset, the rich people and their politicians said, "There is no other way." They repeated this so often many people believed them. Meanwhile, instead of investing in things that most people could use, and instead of providing jobs that paid people well like they used to, rich people found they could make more money on Wall Street. Wall Street is a place where money makes money. Here, the 1% made money so fast that they devoted more and more money to it. They took some of that money and sent it far away, where workers had no rights, to produce things that workers used to produce here. When ordinary people wondered why rich people needed so much money, the 1% said, "Don't worry. This is good for you, too, because it will trickle down from us to you. Someday you'll be rich, and then the rules we made for us will be your rules, too." Some people weren't so sure about this, so the rich people bought newspapers and TV and radio stations and internet companies and paid them to repeat over and over, "Someday you will be rich too. There is no alternative." Soon you could hear people saying, "There is no other way. Someday we'll be rich." Meanwhile, the rich people's money piled higher and higher. But after a while, it was piled too high. One day the money fell down with a big crash. Down right on the houses of millions of ordinary people. It broke their houses. Then more money towers fell down. They fell on ordinary people's jobs. This is terrible. Everyone was scared. How did this happen? The government said, "We have to fix this." They were so used to rich people being rich, they immediately started printing money and giving it to rich people. But they didn't give any to the ordinary people whose houses and jobs were broken by the crash. Those people said, "You give the rich people money to replace their money that got lost in the crash. Why aren't you giving us any to fix our houses and our jobs? They got broken in the crash, too." The government had no answer. Now the people got mad. Since they weren't sure who to be madder at, the government or rich people, they got mad at both. Rich people got worried. They thought, if the people get mad enough at us, they might take some of our money. This really upset the rich people, because they loved their money more than anything in the whole world. So they devised a plan. They called it, "Look over there!" Whenever people said, "How come you rich people are getting richer, while all the rest of us are losing our houses, our jobs, and our schools," the rich people pointed at someone else and said, "Look over there!" First they pointed at the people whose houses were broken and said, "Look over there! Poor people caused the crash! They built their houses in the wrong place! If they hadn't done that, the money wouldn't have fallen on them!" But most people didn't believe them. So the rich people pointed at someone else this time, teachers. They said, "Look over there! Teachers have jobs and you don't. No one can ever fire them. And lots of teachers are bad. The schools are failing. Teachers are the reason. Bad teachers. Bad, bad teachers." Most people didn't believe this. They remembered the problem was the crash, not bad teachers. The rich people realized it might be safer for them if someone else pointed their fingers. So they took some of their money, and even though it was just a little bit of their money, it was a lot of money since they had so much. They helped more people get elected. These politicians pointed their fingers at police, firefighters, librarians, and other public employees. They said, "Look over there! These people are greedy. They have jobs and you don't. You don't have retirement plans and they do. They caused the crash." Some people thought this might be true. They knew someone or something had caused the money to fall. Maybe it was the firefighters. But others remembered that firefighters helped them when their houses were on fire. They also remembered it was the 1% who built the money towers that crashed on their houses and jobs. Some people even remembered those towers of money had replaced factories and jobs that people used to have. And those jobs used to have retirement plans, too. And the ordinary people remembered that the teachers and firefighters lived in their neighborhoods and shopped in the same stores and didn't seem to be the problem at all. The people looked around. They saw too many students in their classrooms. They saw their roads filling with holes. They saw when they needed help, it took longer to arrive. People began to say, maybe rich people have too much money now. And maybe our problems have something to do with the 1% not paying their fair share of taxes. And also, maybe rich people should pay the same rate of taxes they used to when our land was prosperous and more people were better off. The rich people heard these things and grew worried. They told their politicians to pass laws to prevent people from organizing, prevent people from voting, prevent people from having retirement plans. But now the people understood the problem. It was rich people who crashed the money onto their houses and jobs. It was the 1% who got politicians to cut their taxes until there wasn't enough for schools, safe streets, libraries, health care, and parks. And it was rich people blaming everyone but themselves for what had happened. This is where we are now. And we have a question. Is there no alternative? Or can the people of this land do something to live happily ever after?
If you want to share that, it is on the Move On website. It's Hollywood legend Ed Asner has outraged Republicans over this animated short. So, yay.
Yeah, and it's got pretty good graphics.
Yeah, it's quite fun.
They didn't come across on the radio.
Yeah.
I have a few articles, or two opinion pieces and an article on things going on in Indian country, since I live in a little sliver of it. Hopefully, most of our listeners are familiar with the Cobell case, which was about the land trust payments the government had been mismanaging for about 100 years and lost the money, lost the people they go to, et cetera, et cetera. So finally, the Supreme Court says, you got to cough up, and they worked out a settlement, and this was called the Cobell case. Sadly, Ms. Cobell passed away just before the final decision. And Gabriel Galanda, he is in Seattle. He's a well-known Native American attorney working on these sorts of cases, has done some interesting commentary, and I've heard some things on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation and elsewhere about how this is going. So supposedly, the United States meant to send out 300,000 checks at $1,000 each to Native Americans just in time for Christmas or the New Year. So yeah, it turns out it didn't happen so well. Instead of using their current address list, the people in charge of sending out the money were provided with a 6-year-old address list, and checks went everywhere. And much of the problem with the mismanagement of money over the years is that the government would lose track of who had inherited interest in this land, trust land, that had been taken away from Indians for their benefit, and continued taking payments and depositing them in non-interest-bearing accounts with numbers and no names associated, and said, there, we've paid the rent. from one of our own accounts to a different one of our own accounts with no interest, which is a big deal after a few decades. So interesting that this same group was chosen to distribute this money. Well, when they get a check back or they don't have a name associated with the account, and it's up to you as an individual Native American person to contact the government and tell them what your interest is, even though they were the ones tracking it, the government was. And if you don't do that, they just move the money from the current non-interest bearing Interior Department account to another one and say, therefore, you have been paid. So it's the same. And it's been really frustrating. And only a small portion of the money in the settlement, which was in the billions, is going towards this. Another big chunk, about 35%, is going to administer the money. So that's a little bit off the top. The tribes are upset about, obviously. And then another huge chunk of change is supposed to go to Indian land consolidation purchases. Let me see if I can skim through. Gabe Galanda just wrote this opinion piece on the 23rd, so I don't have it memorized yet. $1.9 billion of the settlement is going into the land consolidation effort. And they say it's not out of the Cobell case, but it is. It came directly out of the settlement. Interior stated its intent to focus 90% of that money for fractionated land acquisition and only on 40 reservations. All the other reservations, well, 110 of them, get the other 10%, and the other 300 and some get zip for land consolidation. It's a strange deal. And then there's $60 million in scholarship monies, and some of the tribes in the top 40 list, probably shouldn't have called it that, but the Department of Interior did, like the Indians' Greatest Hits. they're arguing that that scholarship money should only go to their tribal members and descendants. Not every member of those tribes is arguing that. So pretty much it's become another morass of administration. And then the other problem is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs would be both buying and selling the land in these defractionation. The fractionation problem is that when these allotments, the technical term is allotments, were given to Native peoples, you got 80 or 160 acres or whatever, and all of your children got an interest, and all of your children's children got a fraction of an interest, and a fraction of an interest, and a fraction of an interest in all of their parents' and grandparents' land. So it's chopped up. One piece of land may have 200 or 300 people with an interest in it. Right. So the government says, the U.S. government says, that's no good because that makes the land useless and valueless, because if you want to do anything, you need 51% of the ownership to agree. So tribal members don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. Land that you don't develop is not useless to tribal members.
Right.
Getting 51% of, you know, either a dozen or several hundred owners is really hard to do. Well, what this land fractionation buyback would do is try to control 51%, and then you can force the other 49% of ownership to sell. So a lot of tribes, especially in the Seattle conference with the BIA that was held, was it last week? I think, or maybe it was Valentine's Day. They said this is a conflict of interest because you are the buyer and the seller, and you're going to end up with forced land sales. And they said, no, we're not going to have forced land sales. Well, under further questioning, they said, well, yeah, once we get 51%, which will go into the held in trust for the tribe, still paternalistic, not just regular fee land like you and I can buy, then the other 49%. They said, well, yeah, then we will force the other 49%. Somehow that's not a forced land sale. And, of course, the ultimate irony is this is the very group that caused the problem, the BIA. And yet, when the settlement was made, Congress said the BIA will handle the settlement and will distribute the settlement and will decide on the terms of how people get their money. So the very group that caused the problem, the actual individuals who weren't tracking the money, are the ones supposedly paying out this new money. And they, you know, elected a czar, or appointed a czar, horrible term, to be in charge of this. And it continues to go awry, and it continues to cause intra-tribal problems. Because when you get 51% who say, yes, we think the land should be sold to develop, and 49% who say, no, we think it's more important that we maintain individual control of our land and not be forced in this paternalistic trust issue again, you set up the conflict being inside the tribe rather than between the tribe and the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. So that is all a bit of a bummer and very complicated. I was just camping with a friend who works on a reservation in eastern Montana where it's a much bigger deal than a couple of the reservations out here. And it's caused one of their newspapers already to split into two newspapers on different sides of the issue. So it's another divide and conquer, and I suspect, you know, for years there's going to be an ongoing problem with this. And, you know, I don't want to jump the gun, but I bet they end up in court again.
Yeah, 'cause
Yeah, when the BIA has a trust responsibility to protect both tribal and tribal member interests, but they're buying from one on behalf of the other, there's no way they can do that. So, in contrast, there's some good news. The Stalaguamish tribe in Washington has invested $5 million in a company that recycles plastic bottles. I think this is fun. Microgreen Polymers, Inc. is doing something amazing, and Corin Andrews, this is from Indian Country Today, a tribal member and CEO of the Stalaguamish Tribal Enterprise Corp., or STECO, was quick to see the potential as an opportunity to diversify the tribe's economic and development interests. And of course, much of the money coming in is from their gaming enterprise, and then it's reinvested in other things. I live somewhere that gaming has really benefited the larger community, so I'm not as anti as some people. So why did the tribe choose this company for its first non-tribal business investment, and why so much? Andrews says they are located in the same small rural town, Alexandria, Washington, so we saw it as an opportunity to support the local community, and Microgreen is a green business. Its vision falls in line with our values of protecting Mother Earth. You could say we're putting our money where our mouth is, and we're also diversifying the tribe's economic development. So I think this will be an interesting investment to follow. They're trying to, you know, work with a company that's reducing CO2 emissions, and actually all those bottles that we religiously take to recycling, a lot of them are still just trashed.
Right.
There isn't an outcome. There's nobody to buy these. So he talks further on that one 20-ounce plastic water bottle could be turned into 7 12-ounce coffee cups. At least it's a reuse. Other applications can include car and airplane components and building construction materials. There aren't many downsides as far as they can tell at the moment. They have a waterless production facility, which is a huge deal in recycling. It often sucks up too much water. They recycle the scrap, and their process is 93% more energy efficient than creating virgin plastic. So for now, the manufacturing facilities are still in Alexandria, but they are looking to expand into other areas. So I think that's fun.
Where's Alexandria?
I didn't look on the map, but it's got to be out west. It's west of us. It's in Washington.
Right. Okay, I just wonder. I'm not sure.
That's a coastal style word.
Uh-huh.
So I'll Google it.
Uh-huh. That's fine.
Yeah.
Just curious, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now we'll have some music from the Alabama Shakes.
Mm-hmm.
gotta hold on. You gotta hold on.
So that was Alabama Shakes. You gotta hold on. Or actually just hold on.
Lovely. Sally?
I don't
need a Bradley Manning.
Yeah, except I don't have it printed. It's right there.
Oh, okay. So just a reminder that this is yesterday, I guess, marked Bradley Manning's 1,000th day in jail without a trial. And a bunch of communities, 70 communities around the country held rallies for him. It says coordinated action spanned 5 continents. And
people are paying attention.
People are paying attention, yep. Yeah.
Yep. Gosh, poor guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael Ratner and some other members of the Bradley Manning support group did release a statement in The Guardian. Ed Pilkington, who's been covering the proceedings at Fort Meade, which is where he's been, where the trial is, has been condemning the secrecy with which he's been prosecuted, citing the military's refusal to make rulings, motions, and even transcripts available to the press and the public. So basically, people can't even know essentially they can't know how the trial's proceeding or what the government's arguments are. Pilkington says there's a much bigger reason why the cloak and dagger approach of the U.S. government to this trial mm-hmm. should be taken seriously. America doesn't seem to have woken up to this yet, but the prosecution of Bradley Manning poses the greatest threat to freedom of speech and the press in this country in at least this generation. He says the government's aiding the enemy charge puts American journalism at grave risk mm-hmm. as it threatens to turn all government sources into, you know, potential aiders and abettors of terrorism, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I think his next court date is in March.
I think it's coming up fairly soon.
Yeah.
Maybe even next, as early as next week. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so try and follow it. The Bradley Manning Support Group website is a good website.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of excellent information on it.
Yeah, and speaking of rallies, yesterday was also the National Day of Action, time to reduce gun violence. And the Palouse Peace Coalition is in the process of organizing for a local gun control rally, probably the weekend of March 23rd. And we'll keep you posted as to our efforts in this direction. But our statement, and we wanted a statement from the state of Idaho, because we're a big gun state, and we wanted to include the fact that we are from residents of the state of Idaho, but we do support legislation to reduce gun violence and encourage responsible gun ownership. And specifically by, number one, banning the sale of military-style assault weapons. Number two, prohibiting the sale of ammunition magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. And number three, requiring universal background checks for every gun purchase, and by closing mm-hmm. all loopholes, including those in gun shows, which is essentially the president's plan. So, unfortunately, our local representative is Raul Labrador.
If you want to give
him a call, his Coeur d'Alene office phone number is 208, of course, 667-0127.
There you go.
For what it's worth.
mm-hmm.
We're going to play a little two-minute clip. There is a human cost, as we all know, to gun violence.
Every
Every 30 minutes, a child or teen is shot by a gun. These broken hearts represent those wounded or killed by guns since this new Congress began. 2,102 broken hearts. How many more hearts will break before Congress passes common sense gun safety laws?
Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the lands in common and to make the waste grounds grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land. Now everywhere the walls spring up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down.
That is Billy Bragg, The World Turned Upside Down. And I don't know, that's from a couple years ago. I don't know what Billy Bragg's doing now, but I hope he's making more music. So.
I do too.
Mm-hmm. So
tours in Idaho, that'd be good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Great. Well, that'd be awesome, yeah. Heading into the second hour. Are we ready?
Yes. Bring us down.
First off, the first hour we had a headline about people in Spain protesting against austerity, and now on Al Jazeera English today it says that also in Bulgaria tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets to protest against corruption and the country's rising cost of living. That's today's demonstrations came a week after nationwide demonstrations forced the conservative government to resign. More than 10,000 protesters marched in downtown Sofia under the slogan, "End to illusions, civil action every day." They shouted "Mafia" and "All parties out" near the parliament and the presidency, waving white, green, and red Bulgarian flags. Rosen Plaveliev, the president of Bulgaria, appeared briefly before the crowd but was greeted with boos and jeers. He said he was willing to meet next week with trade unions and civil groups to hear their demands and seek a way out of the crisis that forced the resignation of Boyko Borisov, the former prime minister, on Wednesday. Borisov's surprise registration came after demonstrations turned violent, with several dozen people injured and two men setting themselves on fire. One of them died, and the other remains in the hospital with in critical condition. Says the Black Sea city of Varna, where the daily rallies against high electricity bills and deepening poverty began 2 weeks ago, saw its largest demonstration on Sunday, according to local media. So these protests are spreading across Europe, and it doesn't seem like the economy's getting much better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see. In other headlines, becoming the first elected government official to publicly state an estimated number of targets and innocent bystanders killed in U.S. drone attacks overseas, Senator Lindsey Graham told a local crowd in his home state of South Carolina that, quote, we've killed 4,700. Quote, sometimes you hit innocent people, and I hate that, but we're at war, said Senator Lindsey Graham, speaking to a group of Rotarians at a forum in Easley, South Carolina. He responded to a question about drones by saying, we've taken out some very senior members of Al-Qaeda. His remarks, reported by the local Easley Patch newspaper, included a defense of the U.S. of the use of drones despite their propensity to kill innocent bystanders, including women and children. Quote, I didn't want him to have a trial, Graham stated, referring to a U.S. citizen, Anwar el-Awlaki, who was assassinated in Yemen by a missile from a U.S. drone in 2011. Quote, we are not fighting a crime, we're fighting a war, Graham said. I support the president's ability to make a determination as to who an enemy combatant is. It's never been done by judges before. I support the drone program. Graham's remarks have since been picked up by national and international media and Peace Radio due to the fact that he appears to be the first high-ranking U.S. government official to put an exact number on the number of civilians killed by this U.S. practice.
What was the number? 4,700.
That we admit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now in positive news, the city of Toronto took the historic step of becoming the first sanctuary city in Canada on Thursday, ensuring access to services without fear for all immigrants, regardless of status. Quote, this is a historic moment because we are saying we are a sanctuary city and that anyone who is in the city of Toronto will be able to access all the services the city offers, be it in the areas of health, in the areas of parks, in the area of library, in the area of health and safety, said Councillor Joe Mihevec, the Toronto Star reports. That is the kind of city we want. We want to open our arms to anyone who comes here while they are here. Brent Patterson of the Council of Canadians writes that the step marks a rejection of Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government, which, quote, is shamelessly making it harder for people to seek asylum in Canada and sees only savings in reduced spending on social, education, and health benefits from the resulting plummet in the number of refugees. Rights groups praised the new designation. Quote, undocumented people in Toronto avoid city services because of fear of debt, denial of service, detention, and deportation, stated Brendan Bailey, a nursing student and member of Health for All, part of the Solidarity City Network, which lauded the vote. Quote, the passage of this policy means more people will feel comfortable accessing services that will keep them healthy and out of hospital.
I'm moving to Toronto.
Yeah, you could, yeah. As an immigrant there, you could probably get better health care than you can here. So.
Really.
And now we listen to a song by Thank you.
down in number 43. You seem surprised to see me. Just relax, this won't take long, a mere formality. Would you like to have a Coke, a lawyer, or perhaps a smoke? All of these things can be provided. Be shy and don't deny. We've all seen the evidence. Clearly, this is not your first offense. An airtight case, we all agree. Though we've seen worse quite frequently. Nonetheless, you crossed that threshold.
Times they are coming our way, coming our way, coming our way. You know that better times they are coming our way, coming our way. Number 43, the big man, he will be right along. So just relax, it won't take long, a mere formality. The camel small, the needle large. No, my friend, you're not in charge. We've heard it all before, just await your reckoning.
There's a time stay. Coming our way, coming our way, coming our way. And know that better times they are coming our way, coming our way.
Open up number 8. She's standing at the garden.
So that was Cracker. The name of that song was Minotaur. It's from their recent album called Greenland.
And we're going to continue with the human toll, which we do every couple of weeks, sent to me, thanks Tom Hansen, courtesy of the February 18th, 2013 edition of the Army Times. No U.S. service members died in Afghanistan the week from February 1st through February 7th. 15 U.S. service members were wounded in action. And courtesy of the February 25th edition of the Army Times, once again, no U.S. service members died in Afghanistan the week from February 8th through February 14th. And that week, 25 were wounded in action. And from the beginning of this thing, October 10th, 2001, through February 14th, 2013, there have been 2,164 U.S. service members who have died in Afghanistan, 18,276 U.S. service people wounded in action in Afghanistan. We're going to also talk a little bit about some of the other violent occurrences. Since Sandy Hook, there have been 2,058 gun deaths in the U.S. and 184 just this past week, according to a crowdsourced tally run by the website Slate. 184 this week, gun deaths in the U.S. And we are happy that there have been no U.S. service people have died in Afghanistan in the last 2 weeks. But there is, on average, 22 suicides of military veterans every day, or on average, 61 every 65 minutes of military veterans killing themselves. Also, in Afghanistan, there were 214, since we're doing numbers, 214 deaths in Afghanistan this last week from the website warnewstoday.blogspot. Today in Afghanistan is the website. Here's a sample from a particularly violent day, Wednesday, February 20th. Reported security incidents. NATO and Afghan forces have killed at least 25 insurgents and three of their commanders in separate operations around the country, Afghan and coalition officials said Wednesday. An Afghan security operation on Tuesday in Metarlam, the capital city of eastern Lagman province, killed 15 insurgents. The ministry said the insurgents' commander, identified as Kari Almas, was also killed in the raid. Meanwhile, joint operations by Afghan troops and the U.S.-led International Assistance Force killed 10 insurgents on Tuesday in southern and eastern Afghanistan. The coalition said five insurgents were killed in the lawless Andor district of eastern Ghazni province. Three died in an operation in eastern Logar province, and two were killed in southern Helmand province. We've been there since October 2001, and these violent deaths, and we are still there. Our military is still there, no doubt making things worse, of course. So it's we're getting out apparently next year, 2014, after 14 years in Afghanistan, leaving behind this kind of thing, 214 deaths in Afghanistan this last week. Mm-hmm. So nothing to be happy about, people.
Right, right. When we could get out sooner. I mean, what's the point of staying another year?
Or we could have treated 9/11 as a crime,
right.
And addressed it with police action,
right?
Instead of declaring, as you were saying, quoting the senator, we're at war,
right?
We're at war because we've chosen to be at war,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we're doing it at a distance. We're not our people are not dying anymore,
right.
And certainly the drone operators are completely. Safe,
mm-hmm.
except
right.
for the suicide rate is huge.
Mm-hmm.
The suicide rate, the guilt, the sorrow of things that we're teaching our people and young people, mostly young people, to do.
Mm-hmm.
Since we're still being on this mm-hmm. topic, I want to continue with some information. I'm concerned about gun violence in this country, but it's definitely related to this whole military, the violence that we are expecting our young people to embrace,
right.
mm-hmm.
and that
right.
we praise them for when we send them out and arm them with these big whatever weapons, and then when they come back. It becomes a problem
right,
for us.
Right.
So a couple of writers writing in Truth Out, one of my favorite websites, mm-hmm. An article, When Wars Come Home, made this very point, Charles Durber and Yale Mogris, writing in Truth Out this last week. And then they write, in the flood of commentary about the Newtown Massacre and broader U.S. gun violence, liberals tend to blame failures of gun control, then, and I'm right there, while conservatives blame the mentally ill in Hollywood, but they're both missing one important and overlooked explanation, the domestic consequences of a militarized superpower, that's us, engaged in chronic wars around the world. And now we're in, what,
Niger.
Niger. Yeah, good. Starting with 100 troops, boots on the ground, in yet another country that that most of us have to get out an atlas to even find. And we're, you know, supposedly that's keeping us safer. It's all about us. It's all about our...
I don't remember Niger threatening the U.S., but...
No.
Did they have oil?
Yes.
Okay.
It is about money, too.
Yeah. No.
The U.S. spends more money on the military than the next 10 countries put together, which some of us know and which we have talked about many times in this very room. It also has the highest level of domestic gun violence in the developed world. Highly militarized societies cannot compartmentalize foreign from domestic violence. They cannot prevent wars and guns from coming home. And then he goes up, they go on to say, contrast that with Europe, which provides a clear contrast. After World War II, as the United States became the sole superpower, Europe largely renounced militarism and war. Demilitarization is one of the reasons why many European countries, such as Sweden, have high levels of gun ownership for hunting and sports, but have one-tenth the U.S. level of gun violence. If violence is not acceptable abroad, it could hardly be seen as honorable at home. So just to continue here, they go on to say, a militarized society develops a culture and institutions which program civilians for violence at home as well as abroad. War celebrates the heroism of soldiers who use the same style weapons and ammunition used by the mass shooters at Newtown or Columbine. A warrior society values its armed forces as heroic protectors of freedom, sending a message that the use of guns is morally essential. Very confusing for young people.
Right.
Very confusing. So let's say. Anyway, I was struck by the fact that this article ended with quotes from Martin Luther King, who did talk about ended up talking about the war in Vietnam. And he said, I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. And then he went on to say, the war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the human spirit. So the next book I'm going to read, I've got it at home. I'm sort of dreading it, but it's by Nick Terse. And it's called Kill Anything That Moves, and it's about Vietnam. And it's a result of his research, his research on the military's own documentation of the violence in Vietnam. So
we'll brace ourselves for that review.
I'm bracing myself for even starting it. I know it's going to be just... But I've read a couple of articles and heard some interviews of him, and he said, of course, and I think a lot of us knew this, but that the My Lai massacre was
one of many.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, and that's how many years ago, and we're still doing it. So, got some happy music for us, Jill.
we're going to listen to some Bella Fleck.
Yay.
Thank you.
Bella Fleck.
Circus of Regrets.
Yeah, gosh. Well, speaking of regrets, this is about the 10-year anniversary of the lead-up to the war in Iraq, so I think we're going to talk a little bit about what that has meant and what many of us were doing 10 years ago. I know there was a lot of activity here in Moscow and a lot of people out. That's when the vigil started in earnest. But tens of millions of people worldwide were just desperate for this not to happen.
Right.
And it was so sad that it did. Yeah, I remember just crying when I got down, when it was in fact shock and awe, and we knew what that meant.
Yeah.
We knew that wasn't just fireworks and pretty pictures. Anyway, William Rivers Pitt is somebody that's been consistently writing good stuff. Was a teacher, apparently, high school teacher, which is maybe another reason
that's
that I like him.
That's pretty amazing, actually, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was writing an article called The United States of Aftermath, from Truth Out Again, Truth Out, wonderful place. And he writes, the week before, when tens of millions of people had taken to the streets in more than 600 cities around the world. He said his life was a blur of frantic activity. He had written the book War on Iraq, and I was trying to find my copy. It's a slender little book. I couldn't find it. I may have given it away. But it was published in October of that year and argued that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction or al-Qaeda connections to the September 11 attacks. Many of us knew that. He appeared on as many television, radio, and print interviews as he could. But 1 month later, I and every other person who tried to stop it encompassed the totality of our collective failure as we watched huge swaths of Baghdad be incinerated by the shock and awe bombing campaign that heralded the opening festivities, and that was almost of America's 9-year debacle in Iraq. Here's a little bit about why this happened. As he writes, the answer is too simple and cuts too close to the bone. The war in Iraq costs more than $3 trillion to execute, every bullet fired, every bomb dropped, every MRE eaten, every helicopter shot down, every missile fired, every truck destroyed by an IED, every oil well guarded, every uniform worn, and every body bag filled, translated into a slice of that money going to a company connected to the PNAC, the, anyway, the organizers of of the run-up to the war. Members of the Bush administration who lied us into that war as an expression of their personal principles and in fulfillment of their dreams. Halliburton, KBR, United Defense, the Carlyle Group, independent military contractors like Blackwater, and a crowd of American oil companies are still counting the riches they earned from their participation in this carnage.
PNAC stands for the Project for a New American
Century. New
American,
right, right, right. Yeah.
Make it just like the old one.
Pretty horrible people, actually. Yeah. the war against Iraq, in the end, was nothing more or less than a massive money laundering operation that took American taxpayer dollars, soaked them in blood, and redirected them to certain friends in high places. It was a smash and grab robbery writ large, aided and abetted by an American news media, which had its own profit motive, and which made a nifty sum off the whole deal. Even better for them, today they get to enjoy the ratings and advertising dollars to come when they broadcast their somber documentaries about how terrible it all was, how many lies were told, how many mistakes were made, and all without ever looking into their own enormous complicity. They say the war is over, but Halliburton is still getting paid to rebuild Iraq. The military contractors are still there. Bombs are still going off all over the country. The hundreds of thousands of civilians who were killed, or even more, if you think of the Lancet study, are still dead. The hundreds of thousands of civilians who were wounded and maimed are still scarred, and many of the millions who were displaced are still not home. Almost 5,000 American soldiers are still dead. Nearly 40,000 more are still scarred. And the VA is utterly incapable of dealing with the aftermath because we do not tax our our corporations that are wealthy. $3 trillion of taxpayer money was laundered away, and today we have squadrons of politicians who voted for the war and made sure it happened, now talking about cutting Medicare, cutting Social Security, about how we can't afford decent health care, or the United States Post Office, without even a blink of acknowledgement toward their own overwhelming share of blame for what has happened to the nation. 10 years ago, they used 9/11 against us with the happy help of the news media to unleash butchery for a payday and broke the country in the process. William Rivers Pitt, writing in Truth Out.
By the way your hands felt on my face when you drew them close to mine. As days turned to weeks, must be a dream to believe it could be a lie. Now everything's completely changed and I'm running back to you. If I sidestep, will I sway? I come running back to you. Say goodbye to yesterday. Now I'm running back to you. Running back to you. I never should have said I pulled away from what I've learned. I'm underneath the thumb of the one I really love, daring bird.
bridges burn.
Now everything's completely changed, and I'm running back to you. If I sidestep, will I sway? I come running back to you. Say goodbye to yesterday, now I'm running back to you. If I sidestep, will I sway? I'll come running back to you. Say goodbye to yesterday. Now I'm running back to you. Running back to you. Now everything's completely changed, and I'm running back to you. If I sidestep, will I sway? I'll come running back to you. Say goodbye to yesterday. Now I'm running back to you.
That was the War Poets. The name of the album is Dulce e Decorum. And the name of the song was Running Back to You.
Miss Sally?
Hey. This is the time for book and movie reviews.
Woo woo.
Slightly less depressing now.
Oh, wait for it.
Well, I'm saying slightly.
Yeah, okay.
I'm saying slightly.
Very slightly.
But I just finished a book called Kind of Kin. It was recommended by our new youth services librarian, who is from Oklahoma. This book is set in Oklahoma. It's a novel by Rilla Askew. And my first comment is I jot down notes after I finish a book, and all I could say was wow, just wow. It was it's hard to explain in a few sentences because it's a big sprawling family saga kind of book, but it's really beautifully written. I love the characters. Family story set in rural Oklahoma. Subtopic is immigration. One of the characters is married to an illegal alien. One of the characters is a right-wing politician proposing harsh legislation. The main character is a woman, daughter, wife, mother, trying to keep her family together and facing pressures, and she's just so wonderful. She's not perfect, but she's wonderful, and she's brave, and she's, you know, trying to take care of her family. So I really love this book, and it was quite different from many of the things I read, but it was just I think it illustrated the complexity of what we glibly call immigration reform. So it's called Kind of Kin. Mm. So beautiful. Anyway, my other book is Fire in the Ashes, Jonathan Kozol's latest, and I adore Jonathan Kozol.
Yes.
Everything he's written has been just this amazing. This is a follow-up of some of the kids that he's met over the years. He's been writing probably 40 years. His first book was Death in an Early Age, right. I think. following his stint as a fourth grade teacher in a really poor area in Boston. And so he's been writing about poor children and the huge challenges they face for all these years. And this is a follow-up dealing with a few of the kids. So if you remember Pineapple or I'm forgetting some of the other names. He uses pseudonyms for these kids, but the overwhelming impression, or the impression you get after the end of one of his books, is that nobody makes it in these really poverty, in these really poor areas, mm-hmm. without help. Nobody mm-hmm. makes. I mean, we all get help. You and I, the three of us, mm-hmm. have gotten mm-hmm. a lot of help in our lives. These kids facing tremendous poverty and violence, and you know, he describes the Martinique motel where some of these kids grew up. That is just filthy and scary and cold and hot in the summer and whatever. In the schools that are just warehouses and mm-hmm. and the kids that he describes are all kids that he helped personally or he knew. Well, they're all mm-hmm. kids that he helped personally, but also they got help from other caring mm-hmm. adults. And let me just, I'm just going to read a portion at the end if I can find, because he describes so much better than I about what it takes. He said, "The point I need to emphasize again is that all these children had unusual advantages. Someone intervened in every case and with dramatic consequences. In Laura's situation, it was a devoted teacher in a failing middle school, and again, a teacher in an otherwise unsuccessful high school in New York who spotted her as a gifted student. In Pineapple's case, and Jeremy's, and Leonardo's, it was either Martha or someone from outside the Bronx or a group of people from outside New York City altogether who shepherded these children into avenues of exit from the damage they'd already undergone or would likely undergo in the schools of the South Bronx. Other children from the Bronx and similar communities have been given access to good education through programs like just various programs." Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. "All of this, however, depends upon the charitable inclinations of a school or philanthropic donors, and charity has never been a substitute, not in any amplitude, for systemic justice and systemic equity in public education. Mm-hmm. If any lesson may be learned from the academic breakthroughs achieved by Pineapple and Jeremy, it is not that we should celebrate exceptionality of opportunity, but that the public schools themselves in neighborhoods of widespread destitution ought to have the rich resources, small classes, and well-prepared and well-rewarded teachers that would enable us to give to every child the feast of learning that is now available to children of the poor only on the basis of a careful selectivity or by catching the attention of empathetic people like the pastor of a church or another grown-up whom they meet by chance. Charity and chance and narrow selectivity are mm-hmm. not the way to educate the children of a genuine democracy."
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love Jonathan Kozol because he points this out and he gives us a face.
Yeah, he's one of the few academics who can actually communicate well the masses who need the information.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
One of the people that reviewed his books mm-hmm. Is Eric or Kai Erickson, writing in The Nation, who speaks of his warmth, gentleness, a kind of mournful decency. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was amazing. Mournful decency. I mean, he obviously grieves over these kids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that basic decency of just knowing that this should not be. Mm-hmm. Should not be. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Should we read that one in book club?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll recommend it. We got wild after you recommended it.
Okay.
Not we got wild. We read the book called Wild.
And you got wild, too. Okay.
Yes. It was a good discussion. Huh. Do you want movies?
Yep.
Okay. Don't see this one. Damn, spoiler. Carnage, 2011, directed by Roman Polanski, written by Yasmin Riza Polanski and Michael Caton. It's people in a room being mean. I can go home and see that. It's disturbing, so I guess if, you know, you think movies are good if they have an effect on you, it is unsettling. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a little tired of watching the bourgeois argue about nothing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
right. And it, get out and do and, something.
Yeah, it was French, and they translated it into American, and I don't think it went well. Mm-hmm. The French is all about plays on words and things, and the American is just about people being crap to each other. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's plenty of reality TV where you can see that. Mm-hmm. So not that one. Do watch this one. This one was awesome. Hard to get. Fireworks Wednesday, 2006, directed by Oscar Fardi and written by him and Mani Hayigi. I don't speak Farsi. I'm so sorry. It's Iran and their traditional New Year's, which is actually still connected to Zoroastrianism. So it's on one of the solstice. Uh-huh. There's supposed to be a big tradition of fireworks. And that's sort of the background to this whole show. It's kind of shot over a day or a couple of days. And a young lower class girl takes a job keeping house and helping out for an upper class couple whose marriage is in crisis. And this young woman is also looking towards her own marriage and trying to figure out what that means in that society and in her family and how people are going to treat her. And so she's watching this couple delaminate and bringing her experience to that.
Delaminate?
Come apart at the seams.
Oh, okay.
That cool. makes sense.
Sorry. But it's actually very interesting, you know, and there's kin, and of course there's beautiful fireworks, and you get to see pieces of Iran that you don't see in just daily life, mm-hmm. not people being bombed and shot at, just trying to function. And then another super obscure one, which I think I have the only copy probably in the panhandle, but you're welcome to just email the show and ask me for it, and I will loan it out. I found it at Rockin' Rudy's store in Missoula, which is a really cool, has tchotchkes and used stuff.
Right.
Didn't that make? Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. So Phyllis and Harold, 2008, directed by Cindy Klein. She used old home movies and really raw open interviews she got from her parents. I think she's been pointing a camera at them since she was a kid, mm-hmm. so they're kind of used to it, about their 59-year marriage until her father dies. And I think she couldn't have released the movie before her father died. He thought the marriage was great, worked well for him. Mm-hmm. He was a wealthy dentist. Her mom thought it was torture.
Wow.
She was in love with someone else who was married to someone else. And yeah, and about how growing up when her mom did, she thought if you wanted to have sex with somebody, that must mean you wanted to marry them. That's what her mom said. I mean, it was so confused for her. She said in that era, you know, these things were conflated. Mm-hmm. And then she had kids, which she really had no interest in having. So she wasn't overtly mean, mm-hmm. but she wasn't into it. Mm-hmm. And that can be damaging in its own way. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting and personal in a way that I haven't seen in other documentaries. And, you know, what that 59 years was like for those people and their kids is pretty interesting. So seriously, I'll loan it out. I only spent $1. Anybody wants it? And then a little palate cleanser, something reliably good. Where did it go? There it is. The Look, 2011, directed by Angelia Macaron. It's a documentary about Charlotte Rampling, and it's like now. And it's just her talking about stuff with some people. Famous artists she posed for, famous directors she worked with, and just the person making the film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, touches on the fact that she's never had cosmetic surgery, because, of course, heavy-lidded is her look. And she says so many doctors approach her at parties and say, I could lift those. Then I wouldn't be Charlotte. So, you know, she did some really transgressive films about Nazi Germany and sexual exploitation of the Jewish women in prison, and Max Monamour, where she played a woman who got jiggy with the chimp. You know, she did some really strange things. She said at the time she was young, she was just doing what was offered and didn't realize. So it's quite intriguing to watch. And she's not stupid. She took advantage of all these, you know, opportunities to hobnob with the elite and the well-educated, even though she was a young model and not well-educated at the time.
Right.
So that one was actually fun to watch and not nearly as depressing as all the other things I just reviewed. So.
Yeah, very interesting.
That's all the movies.
Yeah. All right, we're going to listen to some jazz.
Better than sailing at midnight, better than diving for pearls, better than skiing at Aspen, better than feeding the squirrels, better than finding a horseshoe, better than losing your head, better than anything thought of, better than anything said, better than singing right out loud or being spotted in a crowd, better than anything except being in love, better than four sets of Dizzy, better than Count Basie's band, better than Rollins and Coltrane, better than being on the stand, better than Ella Fitzgerald, better than Miles' latest news, Bill Evans' ballads and Joe Williams' blues, better than hearing Lady Day or checking in at Monterey, better than anything except being in love.
Show's all fixed. Huntley and Brinkley singing with Mitch. Hitchcock and Cardloff and clicking the switch. Better than movies late at night or watching Emil Griffith fight. Better than anything except being in love. Better than elephants dancing. Better than clowns on parade. Better than peanuts and popcorn and fresh lemonade. Better than rides on the midway and seals blowing horns. Men shot from cannons and fresh ears of corn. Better than balancing on wire or watching tigers leap through fire. Better than anything except being in love. Better than anything except being.
That was Jackie Sutton. The name of the album is Notes from the Frontier. And the song was Better Than Anything. Really nice, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway. Our last little bit for today is that yesterday was the birthday of W.E.B. Du Bois, a prominent civil rights activist. Pan-Africanist author and editor. I'm sure people have heard of him, one would hope. He was actually the first African-American to earn a doctorate, and he got it from Harvard and became a professor of history, sociology, and economics at Atlanta University. He was one of the co-founders of the NAACP. He was the leader of the Niagara Movement, which was a group of African-American activists who were early fighters for equal rights for blacks. He opposed He lived at the same time as Booker T. Washington, who took a much more compromising view towards racial relations, and the two came to heads over the Atlanta Compromise, Du Bois insisting on full civil rights and increased political representation for African Americans. He was a prolific author. You could still find a collection of his essays, The Souls of Black Folk, which was a seminal work in African American literature. And in 1935, he wrote a book called Black Reconstruction in America, which challenged the prevailing view that blacks were responsible for the failures of the Reconstruction era in the South. He wrote the first scientific treatise in the field of sociology. He published three autobiographies. He was editor of the NAACP's Journal of the Crisis. An ardent peace activist and an advocate of nuclear disarmament. He died in 1963, and the U.S. Civil Rights Act, which embodied many of the reforms that he fought for most of his life, was enacted a year after his death. So yesterday was his birthday.
Wow. Wow. What a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And now we will go out listening to Bob Marley, Thank You, Lord.
Sweet.
Hey, No, 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 no,